Trees mean different things to different people, whether it's a giant old oak you used to sit beneath with someone, a big peppercorn that you climbed right to the top of, or a fragrant pine or an impressive boab. Is there an particular tree that has a special meaning for you or that's played some important role in your life? And our guests today have known a lot of trees between them. Tim Entwistle is Director and Chief Executive at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, former host of RN's Talking Plants, and you'll hear him sometimes on Blueprint for Living too. Tim, welcome.
Good morning, Hilary.
Or welcome back, I should say. We've spoken to you several times before.
Yeah.
And Monique Ross, she used to be an ABC journalist, and now she's a forest therapy guide based in Queensland. Monique, hello.
Good morning.
Good to chat with you again too.
You too.
Now, Tim, I'll start with you. Do you have a favourite tree story or a tree that you just like to sit under?
Well, you've already mentioned the English oak, and this might sound a bit predictable, but it's probably my favourite. I mean, I've seen big redwoods in California, and in the mountain ash, I think, near Melbourne are just spectacular, but they're so big, they're almost too big for us to take in, whereas there's an English oak in the lawn called the Oak Lawn, appropriately, in Melbourne Gardens, where I work. And it's a beautiful tree, but it's not only the tree I like, there's a branch. I've got my favourite branch.
And wow.
It extends down sort of across the ground and then lifts up again. It just looks like it's almost defying gravity. It's got a lovely sinuous curve to it. And I love walking past it, looking at it. I don't sit a lot under trees, but I kind of walk around them a bit.
Yes. And I know you've been known to hug a few as well.
I have. I've hugged a tree or two. But for me, it's often just, you know, so I can get close and look at their bark or their leaves or their flowers. That's mm-hmm. That's me as a scientist, you know,
sure.
Explaining why
yeah.
I hug.
Let's,
yeah.
Let's say that, shall we?
Okay.
Monique Ross, you surround yourself with nature every day as a forest therapy guide. Is there a special tree in your life or would that be favourite child territory?
Oh, it's a little bit favourite child territory, but I think that there's something in favourite child as well. So look, my favourite tree at the moment is an Antarctic beech tree, which lives in Lymington National Park in southeast Queensland. It is just this most magnificent tree. It's about 40 metres high and something like 2,000 years old. The trunk has all these really twisted nodules and big exposed roots, and I actually have a favourite root, talking about a favourite branch before, a favourite root that I like to go and sit in, and it's kind of covered in all these soft green mosses and lichens, and it's just such a special place. Like entire worlds exist in that tree, and you can really feel its wisdom when you're with it.
Well, and you can really almost feel yourself sitting there the way you describe that kind of softness and the sensory approach to it. We'll talk a little more about that in a few moments about what it's like to be a forest therapy guide. But I'd like to bring in here Karim Khan. He's a Noongar man from southwestern Western Australia. He's on the board of directors of the Noongar Language Centre, and he's a senior project officer in the Aboriginal Engagement and Heritage Unit at the WA Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions. Karim, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello and good morning, everyone.
It's a very early morning for you. We appreciate you joining us this early. But Karim, a particular tree has a special meaning for your family. Tell me about that.
So within our Aboriginal cultures, or a lot of Aboriginal cultures, and particularly speaking for our Noongar culture over here in the southwest, we have the totem system. And basically a totem in our culture is where a family or an individual is given something in nature that they are responsible for and care for. It can be a plant or an animal. And so my granddaughters, I gave her the totem of the banksia, the bull banksia tree, as her totem. And the reason behind that is because she showed real interest in that plant when we were out on country. And it was sort of, she was drawn to it. And I don't know if she was drawn to it or the tree was drawn to her, but as a grandparent, I was, you know, obviously watching her, and I could see that this was happening, and then decided that was going to be her boronga or a totem in English. And so she carries that responsibility now for life.
And what form might those responsibilities take, Karim?
Really to understand the thing, so whether it's a plant or animal, there might be rules around... like if it's an animal, whether they can eat that animal or whether they can hunt it, or say this plant in particular, taking the responsibility to care for it and understand it, what makes it tick, those kinds of things. So it's almost like nature conservation, I guess.
I was going to say, are there times when that becomes difficult, whether that's because of various, you know, government structures that might get in the way of your access, or just maintaining that connection to country for some people in a post-colonial Australia?
Can do. I mean, we're pretty fortunate here. We have access to country to meet our cultural needs, I guess. So national parks, state forests, those kind of things. We're fortunate in that way. I guess some people might not have that that opportunity, depending on their life circumstances. They're living in cities and don't have access to bushland, that kind of thing. But where there is that access available and opportunities, it's really important for us.
And Karen, what did she say when you said, hey, this is going to be your totem?
I don't think she actually understood it at the time, because she's only little. She's around 3 years old. But as she's growing older and we go bush, she goes and goes to the trees if we're out on country and she's looking for it or them. So I think as she gets older, she'll really understand what that Boronga or that totem means for her.
That's fantastic. Karen, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about your connection to particular trees.
No worries. Thank you.
Pleasure. Karim's a Noongar man from southwestern Western Australia, Karim Khan. He's on the board of directors of the Noongar Language Centre, and he's a senior project officer in the Aboriginal Engagement and Heritage Unit at the WA Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions. And I'd love to hear from you if there's a particular individual tree that you're particularly attached to for some reason. And what's the story behind that? We've got Peter Logan on the line. Peter is from Melbourne. He's a spokesperson for the Save Albert Park Group, which began in 1994, almost 30 years ago, in protest against the Australian Grand Prix. And Peter, I'm really interested in what was the emotional moment involving trees that led to you joining that group?
Oh, good morning, Hilary. Yes, it was. I'm an orchardist as well, so I do love trees. I've got to say I'm biased. But, it was the day they brought in at dawn these forestry teams and chainsaws, etc. We call it Chainsaw Tuesday. And it was just amazing. They just blitzed the whole park. They took out about 400 trees on that day. And in the total overall, this is major trees, it's well over 1,000 major trees were taken out of Albert Park to put a car race track in. So there were 71 people arrested on the day. We had all Melbourne's best lawyers, of course, keeping them out of jail. Because there was a whole lot of emotion about how can the government just come in and do this to a major inner city park.
Yeah, and I mean, there's been a lot of politics around that protest, and it's been a very long-lived movement. But Peter, were those trees important to you before they were cut down, or was it the shock of seeing that damage?
Well, it was a double shock. I mean, I loved the park. I even lobbied Senator Pat Keneally when I was about 13 years old. Can you plant some more trees in the park? He ran the park in those days, so I've got a history going back a long way. But it was like a massive army came in. They had these massive tree grabbers. They'd pull a tree out of the ground, you know, like they do in the forestry work, and trucks, and they just... Everything moved on one day, and then, of course, they did the gradual removal of trees for some time. So the work's out. The park's about 30% devoid of trees because they've got a car race track, garages, room for, you know, it's a sort of a park that's not a park anymore. It's only partly.
Yeah, I think 1,300 trees all up. But, so it's a bit of a shock to the eye, isn't it, Peter, seeing the absence of where you used to see a tree?
Yes, it's just these bare areas now. And people have been born since that happened, and they see that as normal. Oh, parks are just big open spaces. Oh, you have a few trees around the golf course, but nowhere near the roads, you know? But they're not near the roads because it's a car race track.
Yeah, I saw an interesting quote from Ron Walker, who's deeply involved with the Grand Prix, and his perspective was, well, this is one of the most used parks in Australia now, so it's justified its existence. I thought, that's an interesting view of a park, and it's quite different from, obviously, the Save Albert Park Group and a lot of other people who see parks as having other uses. Where do you get your tree fixed now, Peter?
Well, I've got an orchard. I've probably planted a few hundred trees in the last few years with the help of my wife, of course. I've always loved trees. I love walking in the bush, the native bush, and, of course, Tim Entwistle's Botanic Gardens. He's got an olive tree there that dates right back to first settlement of Melbourne by Europeans. So there's a whole lot that I love about trees. And I've got an olive orchard too.
Oh, as you do. Yep, a random olive orchard. Yeah, Melbourne's, we're very lucky in Melbourne when it comes to trees. Peter, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Hilary.
Thanks for your time. Peter Logan, part of the Save Albert Park Group. Very, very long-running protest movement about the impacts on Albert Park of the Melbourne Grand Prix. Tanya from Melbourne, been waiting very patiently on the line. Hello to you.
Hello.
What tree Hello. Is important to you?
I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, when we came by ship from London, my husband and myself, in 1969, ending in Sydney, 5 years later, my husband found a little bit of money. And he found a little money he'd left in a bank in Germany. Huh. And for some reason, he didn't know. He'd travelled around a bit. And with that money, we bought a block of land on a very steep block, almost vertical, in Narrowena in Sydney. And we thought we'd buy a house. I was then teaching. And while I was teaching during the day, my husband did the building he built. He bought a builder's manual from the lands department. And brick by brick, breeze block by breeze block, really, he built a little house, a little one-story house.
And I'm assuming there's a tree that comes into the story too.
It's still there, yes, and it's about the tree, because the first thing I did when we landed, when we got onto the land and walked around, I said, we've got to plant a tree. I've got to plant a tree, which is a new country for us, and one plants a tree. So I bought a Lasiandra, and we planted it, and today it is still there, and so is the little house. And the Lasiandra is right in front of it.
That's wonderful. Tanya, thanks so much for calling in today. Let's take another couple of calls quickly before we go back to our guest, Tim Entwistle from the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria, and Monique Ross, who's a forest therapy guide. Deborah's called from the Sunshine Coast. Hello to you, Zebra. Sorry, Deborah.
Oh, hi, Hilary.
I've been reading The Lion King to my kids, and I think I just called you Zebra. I'm so sorry. Oh. Deborah, welcome.
That's all right. Hi, hello. Thanks, Hilary. When my father was very ill, just before he died, I'd walk along the street in the morning before I went to see him in hospital, and there was a tree, and one day I had my hand on it, and I leant my cheek against the tree. And you know what? I felt such peace in that moment. And, so I call that my peace tree. And any other time when the same thing happened every time. And anyway, since then, this was in Melbourne. I now live in Queensland. Any time I walk, put my cheek on a tree, I just feel this beautiful peace come over me.
That's lovely. It's got memory. It's got peace. It's got, that connection. Deborah, thanks for that call.
Yeah, pleasure.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC RN. Another Debbie from Sydney. Hi, Debbie.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi. What's the tree that's special to you?
Oh, my goodness. So, obviously from the state, I graduated from college, university in 1980, and I recently had a road trip with my 90-year-old mama. And we were going to drive through my campus.
Oh, dear, we're losing you, Debbie. We'll try and come back to you in a moment, because I'd love to hear the story of what you found on campus with you and your 90-year-old mother on this road trip. I hope we can come back to Debbie in a moment. I just quickly want to ask Monique Ross, though, that lovely story from Deborah in Sydney of that sense of peace she got from the tree. What kind of reactions do you get from clients when you take them into the forest and do forest therapy with them?
Yeah, that story felt very familiar to me because I see that happen all the time. I think, you know, most people tend to experience a feeling of real calm or clarity and connection. And also, I see a lot of people be quite surprised at how moving it can be to just slow down and connect with nature. It's a very, very simple thing that I do, but it can be very powerful, particularly around people who are grieving or healing in some way.
And does it kind of change their perspective on other trees as well? Do they kind of look more widely around them?
Yes, yes. You know, I think that we have a tendency, and obviously everyone who's calling in today is breaking this stereotype, which I just love, but we have a tendency as humans to see all trees as being the same. So, you know, all the eucalypts are all the same, or all the oak trees are all the same. And really forest therapy is about looking at what makes something an individual tree or a unique being and connecting with it as an individual thing. And that can be quite eye-opening for people when you start to realise that there's so many different things around you, even within one species.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, some lovely text coming through too. For me, it's palm trees, says Monica. They just look so exotic wherever you see them. And someone else says, remember the shocking removal of Sydney's Anzac Parade Moreton Bay fig, Sally, in Hurlston Park. Heartbreaking, she says, for so many reasons, including the state government prioritising light rail over their magnificence and historical significance. Debbie from Sydney, let's try again. You're on this road trip back to the States with your 90-year-old mum. What happens?
Yes. I am, and I've just posted the photos. So we went back to the university, and if Facebook would not have reminded me of this photo in front of this tree branch, I never would have thought to look for it. And it was there 42 years later, the same low-lying, gushing oak. It was just so amazing. So I've texted you guys the photos so you can see it, but it was just so overwhelming to see it 42 years later. And it was being held up by chains and things, you know, to keep it going.
Wow. What an amazing moment to share with your mum.
Absolutely. And for me and my memories as well. Yeah. It was pretty precious. Yeah.
That's lovely. Well, thanks for sticking with us to complete that story. I want to hark back, Tim Entwistle, to the comments that Karim Khan was making earlier about the Noongar people's relationship with particular plants and trees. And I'm wondering how the Royal Botanic Gardens engages with traditional owners in Melbourne and takes into account the different meanings of plants for different cultures.
Yeah, we do it through lots of different ways. It's been fascinating hearing the stories as well, and Karim's story from WA. And locally here with the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples, there are, you know, all sorts of interesting plant stories that go with the trees that survived in the garden. So we have a few trees that were there before European settlement here and before the gardens were set up, some river red gums, and we have Aboriginal guides that talk through those stories. But we also set up an area called Long Island where we plant and sort of replace local Indigenous plants. And that's another really important thing too, I think, is the plants that grow in your area, the trees that grow in your area, have a special importance. You know, we can plant a tree, and I think that's lovely, but also nurturing and looking after a tree that's been there and perhaps it has an ancestry that goes back many thousands and millions of years, really, the lineage of each of these trees. So it's in a botanic garden, it's telling those stories from all over the world, all those plant stories, but also making sure it has that connection to country too.
And while we're kind of harking back a little bit, I thought we should probably tell people, Monique Ross, what a forest therapy guide does. What happens when you take people out into the forest?
Yes, so I take people out into nature, and basically I just help them to slow down and connect with what's around them in a really mindful and sensory way. So I help people to tune into what they can see, hear, smell, taste, and feel. And the way that I do that is just by offering different suggestions for how people might have a sensory experience. So it could be to notice different textures or to go and look at all the smallest, littlest details they can see. So it's very gentle. It's very contemplative. I like to think of it kind of as a moving meditation, but it can be quite playful as well.
Well, and when we say forest therapy, does it have to be tall trees or can it be other kinds of landscapes?
Absolutely anywhere. So I actually, forest therapy is my certification, but I also like to call it nature therapy because I think that's a little bit more inclusive about where I'm actually going. So I'm guiding in botanic gardens and wetlands and bush and rainforests. And I've heard guides doing an entire forest therapy session with a single tree in a car park. So really, yes, like just standing there for 2 hours with this one tree and just tuning into it in a sensory way. It's incredible. And I think, you know, it's easy to forget that nature is all around us and feel like you have to go to a wilderness area to be immersed in it. But if you're, you know, slowing down and being quite intentional about bringing awareness to what you're noticing and to your senses, you can do this anywhere. You could do it with a pot plant in your house.
Well, I'm wondering how strange it was for the people doing this two-hour session around the single tree in the car park to start noticing something they'd probably walk past every day and not give it a second thought to.
Yes, yes. And that's a big part of what I do is helping people to just notice what they're noticing. You know, a lot of the time that we spend out in nature, we're doing something. You know, maybe we're hiking to the top of a mountain or walking the dog or going for a run or whatever it is. It's still about doing, and so we're a little bit distracted. And I think what I'm trying to do is say, well, what would it look like to just be? To take away the need to achieve anything or meet any goal and just let yourself be in nature and then pay attention to what you notice. And it's really incredible what comes up for people.
I can imagine. Let's hear some more stories of what comes up for people when they contemplate or connect with their particular trees around Australia. Stella's in northern New South Wales. Hi, Stella.
Hello.
What's the tree that you really love?
Yeah, well, as I've been listening to you, there was a tree in my... I grew up with it. I did. I grew up with it. It was a strangler fig. And I leave that fig when I'm probably, I'm about 16 initially. And I go all around the world and I can say that trees in various places, I saw the redwoods in Oregon.
But then you came back to the strangler fig.
Yeah. I mean, even as a traveller, trees can become that sort of, you meet travellers underneath, you know, that tree there or at the post office, at the tree at the post office, mm-hmm. things like that. So trees, you know, I mean, I probably was maybe 20 when I first realised that. And the strangler fig, if I thought of home, you know, like if I went home in my mind.
Yep, trees as little signposts to place and time. Thanks for that, Stella. Hannah's in Brisbane. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind? What tree?
Well, I love the trees of the Border Ranges National Park and particularly between Binnaburra and O'Reilly's. I love the Antarctic beech trees. I think it's the northernmost, I could be corrected on this, the northernmost stand of our Antarctic beech trees, and they are just beautiful, draped in lichen and orchids. And I also love Moreton Bay fig trees. I grew up in Sydney and I lived in Mossman before it was posh, and they were our playground, the Moreton Bay figs.
Oh, wow. There's nothing like an actual bark-covered playground, is there, compared to plastic?
Just wandering around those boughs and in and under them.
I must admit, when Monique Ross said earlier it's an Antarctic beach in Lamington National Park, I thought, that sounds a bit weird, but you've confirmed it, Hannah. Thank you.
No, there are particular stands in northern New South Wales and then, of course, in Tasmania, and they're remnants of Gondwana rainforest, and they're just amazing.
Itself is, incredible, isn't it, when you find yourself face-to-face with something older than it's really hard to get your head around. Rick is calling in from the Snowy Mountains. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi.
What tree cranks your tractor?
Oh, look, I recently returned from a 40,000-kilometre double navigation of Australia on my motorbike.
As you do.
As you do. I was writing a book and the bike was equipped as an ambulance. So I was doing medical relief work up in the Kimberley. And a tree that changed my life and did some truth-telling for me was a massive baobab. It would be biblical, this tree, over 2,000 years old. And it was maybe... In diameter, it would have been 3 or 4 meters, yeah, 4 meters at least in diameter, but maybe 10 or 12 around. Baobabs are very, very impressive trees.
Yeah.
But this one was near Kimberley, in the Kimberley, near Wyndham, and it was hollow. And it had a little hole the size of a small window, and it was called the prison tree.
Ooh.
Yes, I know. But it was covered in carvings from the mid to late 1800s, people's names. And what they used to do was people were put in there, primarily First Nations people, were put in through this hole. And there was about a space in the side of the tree. It would have been about 3 or 4 square meters. And they put about 10 people in there.
Wow.
In 50 degree heat. And they'd stand. It was the great thing for the guard, of course, was because it was such a small. And I went inside it, and it really changed my life. I could just feel the people that had been in there. And they just used to stand one guard outside with a carbine. And it was a convenient way to lock people away.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing tree with an amazing history. And some of the Baobabs in the Kimberley have amazing history. That's just one of them.
I know. And Rick, that's a fantastic story because it shows that, you know, not all trees are benign. Our relationship to them is not always this kind of lovely spiritual thing. As you said, you felt what it would be like to be in that tree for any length of time. John's on the central coast of New South Wales. Hello, John. What's your favourite tree?
Hi. My favourite tree generally is the Sydney red gum, which has the scientific name, Angophora costata. But the particular example I have near me is called the grandmother tree, and it's a very large example of the Sydney red gum perched on a rock on a track called the Hieroglyph Track, which is not far from Gosford. And I was there walking. I've visited a number of times, and I was there walking with a small group of friends, and I sort of speculated, looking at this tree, which has got these amazing twisted branches. And I wondered out loud what the algorithm was that had produced this amazing twisted branch structure.
Science is a bit weird that way, isn't it?
And yes. Well, one of the group with me, Janine, who's a GP, said, no, it's not an algorithm. That tree just has ADHD.
What a lovely way to think about it, John. Thank you. We're talking trees today and some of the interesting and unusual thoughts and connections that they can spark in us because, you know, you think of them as just lovely places you might sit under to contemplate, and they are, but there are also stories coming out of other things that they might connect with in us, other feelings and other stories. Our guests are Monique Ross, who's a forest therapy guide. She takes people out into nature and helps them to really focus on the little sensory details of trees and other plants. And Tim Entwistle is the Director and Chief Executive at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria, who does something similar, I guess, Tim, in the sense that you throw open the gates of your beautiful cornucopia of plants and let people come in. Tim, I wanted to talk to you about being on this expert panel for the shortlist of Australian trees for the ABC, tree species. I think 33 trees have now been whittled back to 20, and now we can all vote for the favourite one. It'll be announced in a couple of weeks. How did you choose that shortlist?
Well, look, it's been fascinating listening to these stories and the tree species people have mentioned as well, because about half of them are still on the list and about half of them didn't quite make it on the list. And well, that's half and half, but there's another couple that perhaps at the edge. So we sat down and looked at there's 3,200 different plant or tree species in Australia. And we thought, which ones are the ones people know most about? Which ones have great stories, which are beautiful, sometimes unusual, making sure they covered across the country. So we need to make sure there are trees from the tropics, from the south, things like the river red gum, which grow all over the country. Things like Wollamai pine, which are so well known, even though it only grows in one little tiny canyon north of Sydney. And, you know, some of the trees that have been mentioned, like the Antarctic beech, in fact, didn't quite make it on the list. Now, it's part of a group, though, which is called Nothofagus, and the Antarctic beech grows up north. There's also species down in Victoria and Tasmania. And one of the ones that did make it on was the deciduous beech, which grows in Tassie and has lovely autumn-coloured leaves, which is very unusual in Australia.
Mm.
So it was really trying to narrow down, a little bit subjective, but you know, it was with sort of some scientists, people from Catalyst, Gardening Australia. We came with to 33. People now voted on those. There were 10,000 people voted, I think, over a week. We got it down, it's whittled down now to 20 names, which does include the Moreton Bay Fig, it does include the Boab, does include the Sydney Red Gum. So all those trees that have been mentioned just recently are still on that list. But it's fascinating to hear people because there's always going to be a tree that's not on there, but we just tried to make it ones that were familiar. So I think, you know, River Red Gum's still there. There's one Banksia serrata, sadly not the bull Banksia from Western Australia, but something for everyone, we hope.
Yeah, I can see how some of the charismatic mega trees might have taken over there, but that's fine. Talk further about that later.
Oh, the mountain ash is in there too, the world's tallest flowering tree. So in some ways you've got to have those, the snow gums.
Oh, yeah.
The gum trees do really, really well there. And I should quickly mention, you were saying the Botanic Gardens here is a place where, you know, people connect to trees but they also see the variety. And I know Monique mentioned this before. This is about getting people to realise there are many, many different trees in Australia. And even with eucalypts, there's 700 different kinds. Or if you go out to our Cranbourne Gardens here in Melbourne, you'll see there is so much variety perhaps that people don't normally recognise. So it is about that whole thing of diversity.
Well, and trees come in and out of vogue too. Where are we at with natives versus introduced species at the moment, Tim, in terms of our urban planning? And does it matter?
Look, that's a really interesting one because I love Australian plants and I grow quite a few of them in my own garden, and we do out at Cranbourne as well, of course. But I'm very keen on it being a patriotic thing rather than perhaps a nationalistic thing. So I was listening to The Minefield on this station just last week with Walid Ali and Scott Stevens talking about the difference between being patriotic and nationalistic. And I think we do that, and we should do that with our plants. So we should be proud and pleased about all those lovely Australian plants. They attract wildlife. They often work really well and survive the climate we live in. But there's not much difference between picking a plant from Perth, if I live in Melbourne, to one from New Caledonia. So we don't need to be too sort of desperate about whether it's from Australia or not Australia. So I love that kind of mix and the fact we can celebrate but also welcome plants from all over the world. And I suppose the other thing I find about Australian native plants is, yes, some are going to be drought tolerant, but some come from tropical rainforests or some come from wet areas. So it's not always a guide to how they grow. So you need to pick a plant that will do well. It's not going to become weedy, doesn't need too much water. And if you're living in the middle of a city, you build a house, you put a road, and then you're worried about putting a rose bush in the front, I think you've got your priorities a bit skewed around. So, go with trees you love, I think.
We talked before about how many people had voted. And Jonathan Webb, who runs the science show here at RN, says it was 100,000 votes in round one.
Jonathan is always right. That's correct.
And he listens. He's on the ball. And it's up to 50,000 votes in round two already. And he says he's loving the tree chat. Thanks, Jonathan. Excellent work with the tree voting. Just quickly, Monique Ross, what are the health benefits of forest therapy? What is it about forests and trees that are behind this research?
Oh, there are so many for our physical, mental and emotional health. I think a big one is just linked to the fact that you're slowing down and kind of de-stressing. So there's lowered blood pressure and heart rate. It can activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the good one, the rest and digest one. It can help combat anxiety and depression and help our energy and mood. A really interesting study, though, which is kind of the study that was the genesis for this practice of forest bathing or forest therapy, was done in Japan in the 1980s, and it looked at what happens to humans when we're exposed to forest environments. And it actually found that the trees in this study were giving off a chemical called a phytoncide, which kind of acted like a natural defense system for those trees. So it was helping protect them from bacteria and attacking fungus and things like that. And the humans that were bathing in those areas, kind of immersing themselves in that atmosphere, they were absorbing phytoncides through their skin or inhaling them in the air. And the phytoncides actually triggered the production of a special cell in their bodies called an NK cell, or a natural killer cell, that sought out and destroyed stress cells. So just being in the trees was actually helping boost their immune system, I think is just incredible.
It is amazing, isn't it? And I looked at that study. It was pretty compelling. Though the people who in that group had gone out for 3 days, I think. Can you get the benefits even if you just pop out for a couple of hours?
Yes. So I think the latest research that I'm aware of is that 2 hours a week is a really magic number, and you can break it down into little 20-minute chunks.
Great.
So 20 minutes of kind of mindful, intentional time. Take your lunch break outside and instead of scrolling, just gaze up at the clouds. That is going to be really beneficial for you.
I really want to get a couple more people's stories before we have to wrap up today on Life Matters. Paul is on the road to Canberra. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
How are you?
Good. What's your relationship to trees?
Well, I'm a tree surgeon, and I've been climbing trees for 37 years.
the eternal child, but also a professional.
Yeah, professional. There's some good points and bad points with my job. I do have to remove some big trees, but dangerous ones that are either fractured or broken or storm damaged or fire. But I also replant. So I run two books. So every tree I take out, I put four back in.
Oh, fantastic. And do you have a favourite, or is that a bit hard to choose?
Yeah. My favourite would be, I can't remember the botanical name, but it's a Tasmanian rainbow gum. I love it because it reminds me of kids playing with crayons and how the bark changes with every season. It's never the same, but it looks like kids have been playing with crayons on the bark of a tree.
Which is pretty amazing, isn't it, in the Australian bush, which has those more kind of muted tones that we're used to, and then every so often this pop of colour.
Yeah, that's right. So I would love to put one in my backyard. I live on acreage, I'm lucky enough, and I've got well over 400 gum trees in my backyard, but I still plant 15 a year in my backyard. Can't
Excellent.
Stop.
Oh, fantastic. Paul, thanks so much for your call.
Just word to the wise of everybody that's listening out there. It really, most trees in suburbia need professionals to come in and give formative prunes, not massive removals. If we actually do light work over time, like look at a tree every 3 years and probably just do it a little haircut in suburbia, we can keep them.
All right. That's investment in healthy trees. Good to know. Thanks, Paul. I want to whip through another couple of calls before we have to wrap up because there are some lovely stories coming through. Ken's in Dungog, north of Newcastle. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Hillary, and hello, Monique. I have a tree. It is a giant strangling fig tree. It's not mine. It belongs to everybody. And it's in a gully on the edge of Barrington Tops National Park. And I ran school camps, hundreds of them. And so thousands of children have been not only past this giant strangling fig tree, but inside the giant strangling fig tree. So the strangling fig starts as a seed and it grows and it wraps its trunk around the trunk of a host tree. And eventually the host tree dies and rots away. And then there is the hollow. And so kids could climb in through the trunk of the strangling fig and inside the hollow. But not only that, but it was possible to climb the tree quite easily, for some of the way up at least.
Wow.
And I have to introduce you to a term, which is negative geotropism, which Tim Entwistle will know all about. But it is the reverse of roots going down into the ground. So negative geotropism. Earth trop- escapism is going away from the earth. So any child that you have who is really keen on climbing trees, you can explain to the relatives that the child is suffering from negative geotropism.
Not suffering, experiencing. Ken, that's great. Thank you. I'm loving how we're getting the dark side of trees too here. They just swallow other trees whole and let them rot away. Arthur, calling from Sydney, welcome to you.
Yes, hi. Look, this is a story from my childhood, and I think the thing with children and trees is a bit of a connection. Sorry, am I on?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, yep. And we grew up in the Sydney suburb of Rozelle in the back of our homes, and it was a Greek family, so we had two or three of us living within a few blocks, houses of each other. Behind our homes, we were on the edge of a cliff. There was a demolished factory. And if you can imagine an L shape where the back of the fences were, at the far end of that L was this lovely loquat tree with beautiful ripe yellow fruit. And we, as children, used to climb through holes in our fences, walk along the small gap, which was probably 2.5 feet wide with a massive cliff on the side, just to go and play in this tree and eat the loquats. Now, in today's risk-averse society, we'd never consider that appropriate behaviour, and I certainly wouldn't let my kids do it. But it was the tree. You know, we waited for it every year. We climbed through the fence. We went up there and played with it and ate the fruit. And it was a special thing, a special bonding thing for myself, my cousins and the kids in the street.
I know, we're such hypocrites as parents. It's like, oh, that was a great time. Don't even think about it. Yeah, I have these great memories of climbing up onto the shed and getting the kumquats that overhung the shed and a tennis racket and piffing them into the backyard. Fun times in the 70s. Quickly, I reckon we can squeeze in a call from Julie from New South Wales. Hi, Julie.
Hello there. Nice to talk with you. I wanted to mention I had a lovely stand of paper bark trees where I was working at the former quarantine station on North Head. And as a migrant, I just felt like there was something about them that they needed to teach me, and I spent a lot of time with them. But I also recently did a research project for my master's degree, and I developed a embodied awareness practice looking at when people paid attention to the non-human, what we normally call nature, what happened? How did they pick up on those connections, those relationships? And while most people went out to what they thought was, you know, a beautiful tree or a natural environment, one of my participants actually did the practice in a car park because she was challenging herself to find a sense of the natural world that we're always connected to in that kind of environment.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it really harks back to Monique's story from before about how you can find an instance of nature close to you, even in a what you might think of as a fairly kind of degraded, non-natural area. Thank you for that call, Julie. We've got lots of texts coming through on this too. We'll get to a couple more calls, I think. We're going to squeeze some more in. But David says, we have a beautiful little snowman, Eucalyptus porciflora, I think it is, that my wife and I planted in our backyard in Blackburn in Victoria. And he says, we used the flowers to decorate my wife's coffin in 2020. It makes it very hard to downsize away from this wonderful garden. But David says, it helps me understand just a little bit the pain Indigenous people must go through losing their country. And another says, Erica says, I also had a hugging tree in Seven Little Australians Reserve. It was a huge white gum which used to shed its bark, revealing fresh skin. And Erica says, I love the cool of the skin on my skin. One time I finished my hug and then saw a huge furry caterpillar right nearby. And that is nature, isn't it, really? You can be right amongst it without really noticing. Tim Entwistle, I wondered how the plants and trees at the Royal Botanic Gardens are coping as the climate changes.
Well, we do have to adapt them, if you like, or adapt the whole landscape. And just a few years ago, we started to plan for every new tree we plant now. We say, look, this is going to live for 50 or 100 years, which we know, or maybe longer, so that every time we plant a tree now, we run through where it grows around the world, where it grows, you know, temperature and rainfall, and will it survive in Melbourne's climate in the next 50 or 70 years? So we do know it's warming up, it's drying. We know that some trees are suffering. I mentioned our oak lawn, and in there we know that when we replace an oak, and we've done this recently, we're looking at oaks from warmer parts, from maybe California. So perhaps not an English oak. It could be an Algerian oak, which actually comes from a bit further south, but looks the same kind, you know, has the same kind of look. So you want a tree that fits in the landscape, does the same kind of things, but perhaps is better adapted to the climate. So we do have to very much adapt to those changes. And our goal at both Cranbourne and Melbourne is to keep those two gardens looking like they do now, with the same kind of characteristics and beauty and the things people love, the big old trees, but to make sure we are thinking about the future when we plan. I think that's true for everyone in their own garden, in their own home. This tree poll that we're doing at the moment is all about thinking about different kinds of trees, perhaps trees that are suited for where you grow, where you live, perhaps trees that are, you know, will do better with a changing climate, because we have to adapt, you know, at the same time, of course, try and reduce the impact we're having on climate as well as people.
Yes, indeed. Monique Ross, do you find when people have been out into nature with you and immerse themselves in the way that you do with forest therapy, that it makes them keener to take any action around climate change and preserving the natural spaces they've been in?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, forest therapy is a sensory practice, but it's also a relational one. It's about exploring the relationships that we have with trees and nature, and also, you know, how we can support its health, you know, how we can support the health of the planet as well as taking a benefit from it. And I think really you only fight to save what you love, you know. All these people who've been calling in with their beautiful stories of protecting trees and taking action to stop them being cut down, that's because they have a relationship with them. So I think the more we can get out and really connect in that way that we're talking about this morning is it's what we really need to do to save the planet, I think.
Well, and we've still got calls and texts coming in about the different kinds of connections people have with trees. Let's go to Beverly in Carrum Downs in Victoria. Mm-hmm. Beverly, welcome to you.
Thank you for your wonderful show, Hilary, and your wonderful guest speakers today. First of all, my favourite tree as a child was a peppercorn tree with the big fat caterpillars. I went to school in North Melbourne, so we had a wonderful tree there. But the reason why I'm ringing is I, 4 years ago, moved into a downgraded two-bedroom unit, a cul-de-sac at the end of a circular driveway with a beautiful 100-plus-year red-flowering gum in the centre, which is why I chose this. Heritage listed, by the way. I now feel like I'm grieving for a loved one. A couple of weeks ago, 7:30 in the morning, six men with chainsaws hanging from the tree, removing the healthy limbs, I might add, butchered the tree. I tried and pleaded with them. They just ignored my pleas. If I was younger, I would have hugged the tree. Mm. Now I'm left with what resembles a stick figure tree, you know, a healthy tree. My heart's broken. And this was my therapy tree, as Monique is talking about. And it attracted many species of birds and bees and was my go-to over COVID to sit under and to feel protected.
And it is really hard, I think, that we're hearing a lot of stories of people's connection, Beverly, to trees that are gone. You know, sometimes those feelings continue even if, sadly, the tree is gone. I'm so sorry to hear about that loss, Beverly. Thanks for your call. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National, and our guests today have been Tim Edwisill, Director and Chief Executive at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, and Monique Ross, former ABC journalist, now forest therapy guide based in Queensland. Tim and Mon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Hilary.
Thank you so much.
This is RN.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.